This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick at rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of Florida Spectacular. We're feeling pretty good. I am back in Florida. Rick is still in Florida. And I don't know where our guest is. So let's just get right to it. Today, our guest is Michael Grunwald. And I joked with him before we started the show that I was sentenced to read him in grad school and then went back and read him for pleasure after grad school. If you're a big Florida person, you've probably heard of his first, was it your first book, The Swamp? Was that your first book, Michael?
It was.
Yes.
It was.
And while it's a wonderful history and I didn't agree with some of the conclusions, it was an engaging read and I think it should be required reading for everybody who loves Florida. And Michael has a new book called We Are Eating the Earth. Is that it?
That's right.
I am not that far into it, but I got to tell you, it's not exactly a life-affirming book. There's clearly a lot of research. I mean, I'm ready to just give it up. And I was outside doing some weeding in one of my little garden beds this morning. And I was thinking, I should clear this out and really just grow my own eggplant. I should grow more eggplant because between you and Michael Pollan, I'm never doing anything again. I'm never getting in a car. I'm never getting on a plane. You know, but it's an interesting book, and I think it's worth talking about. I'm going to jump right in. How did you decide this was a book you wanted to write?
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I think the short answer is that, as you know, I've been basically writing at least part-time about the environment since I wrote The Swamp, you know, now 20 years ago. Oh, my God.
Was it that long ago?
Wow.
Yeah.
I am getting
that?
So old. I'm sorry. Yeah. Let me get my AARP card, which isn't even a joke anymore.
Yeah, no, me too. Anyway, so that meant writing about the climate. But for me, that had always been energy and climate, which I think for most people write about the climate. I actually had when I was at Time Magazine, I wrote an energy and climate column. And essentially, food is about a third of the climate problem. And it's farms use 70% of our fresh water. They're the leading driver of deforestation, the leading driver of water pollution, water shortages, biodiversity losses. They're a big freaking deal. And I realized I was an environmental reporter and I knew like nothing about them. So that's the sort of short answer of how I decided like, hey, I want to write about this, you know, one third of the problem that gets, you know, maybe 1/100th of the attention. You know, there are 1,000 books about energy and climate. And I will say, although, you know, sometimes it is a little bit of a tough book, some people have been like, my gosh, you're such an optimist. And the main reason is, you know, okay, 20 years ago, when I started writing about energy and climate, there were like no alternatives to fossil fuels. And now you see like this solar and wind and even geothermal revolution, batteries, everything's going crazy. So it's true that on food and climate, I write about dozens of promising solutions and none of them have really gotten anywhere yet, but they could.
They could. I mean, I got to tell you, this is my guilty thing. I'm a travel writer and I make my living going around the state, and that gets expensive because I don't know how the climate change journalism industry is going, but you know, the days of just getting, well, first of all, I don't like to be hosted for a lot of places because there's a quid pro quo, but it gets expensive to do the research and travel around. So we bought a used travel trailer a few years ago and we upgraded it, but upgrading it meant that we had to get a bigger vehicle. And we looked at electric trucks, and I have my own reservations about electric vehicles anyway. Not feasible when you're towing something. And we ended up buying this Dodge Ram that I'm like, God, it's just, this is horrible. My carbon footprint is ginormous. But in reading the first few chapters of your book, I'm like, oh, it doesn't take ethanol fuel. So that's great. I'm doing something good for the planet. I can't use ethanol in the gas tank.
And I have to say, her truck is just one notch down from a semi. It's that big.
It's not even as big. It isn't. It's a 1500. It's huge. It feels like a giant. It feels like a beast. We have a golf cart that we inherited, and we have an old Nissan that we drive. And I love the truck. I mean, it's new. Who doesn't love a new car, right? We're a conspicuous consumption society. But I love that old Nissan. I mean, I try not to drive the truck if I can avoid it, but we're trying to extend the life of the Nissan.
That's because you can't find a place to park it. That's why.
I actually already put a scratch on it trying to park it because I am apparently that woman trying to park it in downtown.
I try not to be that guy, right? I'm not.
You can be that guy.
No, I'm not scoldy about this stuff. Look, like I have an electric car. I have solar panels on my roof, but I fly way too much, right? Like we all have an impact on the climate, on the planet. And I do, obviously, this is a touchy subject, right? Because we vote on food and climate issues 3 times a day. And people don't want to be told how to eat. And I'm not telling anybody how to eat. But if you want to know what types of diets are better for the climate and better for the planet, it's pretty simple. Because, yeah, you know, most people have a kind of sense. I had a sense before I started it, but I wasn't sure. I started my reporting inadvertently. I was doing some fact checking and I called a guy I knew and I asked him, is meat really that bad for the climate? And he said, yes. And then he said, duh. But to me, you know, that was sort of when I realized, like, God, if I don't even know that. But it's, you know, yes, the world eats 350 million tons of meat a year. And it turns out that eating plants is a lot more efficient for the planet and the climate than eating, you know, animals that have eaten plants. And it turns out that beef is really the baddie. It's like 10 times worse than chicken or pork. And the main reason is because it eats more of the earth, right? Everybody talks about the burps and farts, and that is a real problem from cattle and other ruminants. But this is really a book about land use. When I say we are eating the earth, agriculture is what's eating the earth, right? 1 of every 100 acres of the planet are now cities and suburbs. 2 of every 5 acres of the planet are now farms or pastures. And a lot, you know, 2/3 of agricultural land is pasture, and 3/4 of it supports livestock, and most of it is for beef. One of my favorite statistics is that in the United States, we use more than half of our agricultural land to grow beef, and it provides about 3% of our calories.
Wow.
It's, you know, between you and Michael Pollan, I think if I ever question, I try to eat a mostly plant diet, but I have these moments where I'm like, you know, a lasagna would be great now. And I just pile on the cheese, or I, you know, every now and then I'll get a craving for a steak. What about things like, I remember in college, back in the 90s, when we were so cute about climate, I took a class called Biological Problems. And I remember the professor saying that cows were bad, beef was bad, you shouldn't eat bad. But if we really wanted to still have the taste of beef, we should eat something called the eland or the eland. What about other, I mean, what about that? Like, there's a restaurant by us that sells camel and elk and bison and all that. Are those any better?
They're probably a little better. And if it's wild caught, like venison is actually great.
Because
it is delicious. And if you're eating a wild venison, you know, by culling that venison, you've reduced its burps and farts because they're ruminants too. And they don't take land. They're just part of the ecosystem. So actually venison is great. I guess on other ruminants, it sort of depends how it's raised. I mean, bison is probably a little bit better than cows, but not much. Some people are talking about it, that ostrich could be better. The key, and this is really this is where Michael Pollan gets it all wrong. Sorry,
Ooh.
He's a great writer. But the key is really efficiency, right? It's how much food can you make per acre, because otherwise you're going to need more acres to make food. And a lot of the Michael Pollan sort of romanticizes these sort of old style farms where the soil is treated with love and the animals have names instead of numbers. And there's the red barn and the farmers look like they're in American Gothic. But the fact is, like, low yield farming eats more of the earth. there is, like, I understand why people get upset about industrial agriculture. There are a lot of terrible things about it today. You know, they treat animals badly. They treat people badly. Their politics usually suck. You know, they use too many antibiotics. But the fact is, like, factory farms are really good at making, you know, manufacturing a lot of cheap food. And over the next 25 years, we're going to need 50% more food, and we're going to have to do it without using more land. Right now, the world is on track to deforest another dozen California's worth of land by 2050.
Couldn't we
don't really have another dozen California's worth of land to spare. And so when you hear people say, like, oh, well, beef may be bad, but we're just going to do grass-fed beef. No, like, fully grass-fed beef is actually worse for the planet and the climate than feedlot finished beef, because it takes the animals longer to get to slaughter weight. So they spend more time burping and farting methane, and they use way more land. So that means they cause way more deforestation somewhere around the world.
Couldn't we just stop making more people?
You know, it's funny.
I feel like we dance around this, but if we stopped reproducing at such a rapid rate, we would have a lower need for food.
Well, let me tell you, first of all, I think when people say, like, oh, there are just too many people, it's kind of like, well, who do you want to get rid of, right?
Oh, I have a few.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like sometimes it's like there's going to be like Thanos, and we're going to like snap our fingers and half of us will be gone, and everything will be wonderful.
That's like Craig Pittman level shout out right there.
There you go. Well, you know, Craig and I go way back, so... You know, look, for the first thing I would say is that in most of the world, birth rates are already heading down towards replacement level, just about everywhere except sub-Saharan Africa, where you still have, like, you know, 5 kids per child, just about everywhere else. In poor countries, in rich countries, in Iran, in Bangladesh, like, it's not a cultural thing. Basically, places where they're educating girls, where they're reducing infant mortality, because basically when girls are educated, they tend to have fewer kids and they start later. And when you reduce infant mortality, basically parents don't have to have like 5 kids to make sure that 2 survive. You know, when they're doing those things, you can get towards replacement level of about 2.1 children per woman. And I think that's like a reasonable goal. I never tell people to have kids or don't have kids, but I think, like, you know, for a society, like, that's, you know, kind of richer societies tend to have fewer children. And I think that's a good thing. You know, it's that said, like, even if tomorrow birth rates everywhere around the world went down to 2.1. That would reduce the projected population by 2050 by maybe 4%, because there are just so many women of child rearing age right now that that population growth is kind of baked into the cake. We're heading towards, it looks like now, maybe 9.5 billion. A few years ago, I would have said 9.7 billion. So you can make a change, but, really, there's going to be population growth. And of course, these next couple decades are when we really need to make a difference on climate change. So
I'm impressed that you think you have that long.
Well, look, I mean, it's, you know, I write about the land sector, right? And, you know, the classic line about how the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best time is today. That is literally true for the land sector. Just like I talked about with our diets, perfect usually isn't on the menu, but better is better than worse. And so, yes, we need to start working on these issues now. But the fact is, most of these, it would be awesome if everybody went vegan tomorrow. That would solve a lot of our problems. But I'm not. I've cut out beef and lamb from my diet, which turns out to be not as good as going vegan. And, like, we all kind of have to find the level of hypocrisy that we're comfortable with. It's kind of like religion.
But it's pragmatism, not hypocrisy. You're pragmatic.
I think it's a little, I should, you know, if I were going to do the best thing I could for the climate, I'd go vegan. But it turns out that I'm weak and I love meat. cutting out beef and lamb turns out to be about as good as going vegetarian, which is also really good. But vegetarians tend to eat more dairy. And again, cattle are the problem. And, you know, again, like, dairy is even worse than chicken and pork, but it's better than beef because cattle produce milk like several times a day. They only produce beef like once in their lifetime.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it such just spectacularly inefficient form of food. They're not very good at converting their food into our food. And that's why they use so much land.
What about all the, remember, there was a big deal about them making meat, in a lab, you know, it was kind of bioengineered. I haven't heard anything about that in years.
Well, you know, in Florida, in the free state of Florida,
that's why I'm not hearing about
has freaking banned it. He has said that you cannot, you know, like we are not, even though it hasn't even hit the market, the first cultivated pork meatballs are about to hit the first retail store in California in the coming months. But it's not going to happen in Florida because our Republicans who care about the free market and free competition have banned it, which is absurd. I've eaten cultivated burger, cultivated chicken, cultivated sushi, cultivated lox. And this is basically, they call it lab grown, but really it's going to be grown in breweries. It's like they grow it like they grow beer. And it's delicious. It tastes like meat because it is meat. It's not yet cheap enough to sort of compete in the marketplace, but it's getting there. And it's an awesome solution because it uses 90% less land to feed cells as opposed to feeding animals. And it creates about 90% fewer emissions. I don't think we're not going to all convert to cultivated meat tomorrow either, or plant-based meat, which, you know, I don't know if you've had Beyond Burgers and Impossible Burgers.
Yeah, I don't eat meat. I don't eat meat.
They're okay. They're not as good as real burgers yet, so they haven't done that great in the marketplace.
I actually prefer the Impossible Burgers to real burgers.
Yeah, I think it's a paradigm shift more than anything.
Are you a vegetarian?
Me?
Yeah.
No, I go for 5 out of 7.
Interesting. Well, look,
I haven't eaten meat in years, and I just don't crave it anymore. So when I get a Beyond Burger or Impossible Burger, it's like that's the standard, and it's not like I'm comparing it to a real hamburger.
You know, I mean, I think they've done a really good job. They're also horrifically bad for you. They're actually worse
that's
for
not
your.
True. That is
no,
not
I mean the stuff they put that's in them true. Is not healthy.
Not true. I mean, again, it's like it's not health food, but it is probably slightly healthier than beef. And one of the things is the cow is a pretty mature technology, this stuff is going to get better and cheaper and healthier, because one of the things, like, you know, humans not really great at making sacrifices for the common good or for the planet, but really good at inventing stuff. And this stuff is, you know, it came out, people were really excited about it. It's like, oh, biotech burgers, and they tasted better than the old kind of veggie
burger
hockey pucks. And so people tried them and people got excited about them and they were like, this is cool. But in the marketplace, they have not done better than beef. Now, I will say plant-based nuggets outperform chicken nuggets in blind taste tests. There's no longer any reason to eat a chicken nugget. I mean, who the hell knows what's even in a chicken nugget anymore, right? I mean, it's like, and obviously they're just like vehicles for sauce anyway. But that, to me, that's exciting. It shows like, you know, they used to be worse. Now they're better. They're not yet cheaper, but they're getting cheaper. And so I think this is like, you know, this is how the world changes. It's usually not overnight. But I think, you know, at some point I eat Impossible Burgers. I think they're pretty good. I still miss beef burgers, which I thought were, you know, absolutely delicious. But so far the fake steaks are not there yet. I think that's something that cultivated, you know, making them from actual animal cells will do better. Cause I will say when you eat cultivated meat, and I know not many people have, cause it's not really on the marketplace yet. But I will tell you, like, our ancestors started eating meat 2 million years ago, and we really did evolve to sort of enjoy the taste. And when you eat a cultivated burger, even when it's just a little bit of cultivated meat blended with plants, it's like 2 million years of evolution saying hi. It's like something goes off in your head, like, that's me.
That is interesting.
Don't you think there's, like, you know, I think about, like, my brothers, you know, he dates a girl and she has a kid and they have their own kid, and they've been vegan the whole time. So mm-hmm. they don't have this paradigm of, you know, they miss a steak or miss a hamburger because they've never had. So if you're not, do you think there's something deep within them that desires something that's comparable to meat? Because one of the things I think is always odd about, you know, these plant-based meats is they're always, you know, plant-based chicken or plant-based hamburger or plant-based sausage or whatever. But if you never ate meat, what's the point of trying to make it a meat substitute?
Well, I guess, the first thing I would say is, like, if you're vegan, that's awesome. That's like, you have the best diet for the planet, but like globally, you are a rounding error. You are not the problem. And the point of these, you know, most of these companies are actually founded by vegans. Ethan Brown, Pat Brown, Uma Valetti. I know all these guys, and they're all mission driven, and mostly mission driven to save animals and save the planet. That said, they know that their customer is not them. If you are going to change the world, you have to change the 99% of us who eat meat. And the vegans don't matter. They're already not causing a problem with their diets. So I fought with this with Ethan Brown, the head of Beyond Meat, who thinks he thinks Beyond has, you know, been kind of screwed by the meat industry because they've put out all this propaganda about how it's ultra processed garbage. And he's right that it is a lot of propaganda. And in fact, this stuff is not so terrible for you. But the fact is, the dogs didn't like the food. Beyond was at $250 a share, and now it's at $2 a share. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because they've been kicked out of just about every fast food joint that they had a contract with because people just didn't like it. Oh. And it's incredible. It's an amazing feat of technology to make a burger that's 90% as good as a burger. But unless you're like me and you're writing a book about food and climate, most people don't want a burger that's 90% as good as a burger. They want a burger that's 100% better or better, you know? So look, I'm really optimistic that this stuff will continue to get better. But I think that's going to be a technological problem. Like, you have to meet consumers where they are. And the consumers you have to meet are not the vegan consumers. It's the people who love meat.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's you're always going to get to the people who you're going to have a problem getting to the people who are just going to decide simply because it isn't meat, they won't even try it, or they approach it with the... You know, my best example is in my mother's mind, and I don't think she listens to the podcast anymore, the only fish she likes is flounder. And so what we have done is we will buy other fish when we have her over and tell her it's flounder. And she loves sure. it. Exactly. But if she knew it was mahi or, you know, corvina or something like that, she would just know, I don't like that. And she would smell it and say no. But if she thinks it's flounder, she'll eat it.
I think there's something to that. And that's why it's been so important for these companies. And a lot of them, they were sort of originally, they wanted to be sold in the meat aisle. And now they're not. And I think that's been a problem as well. Because the idea is, like, they want to see themselves as meat competitors, as meat, right? That's the idea. In the same way that, like, you know, when they first came out with ice, like, you know, there was sort of like natural ice, and then there was like artificial ice. And now obviously we've become okay with artificial ice, but at the beginning that was like a big issue. Now you see with phones, right? It's like, oh, these are cellular phones. These are mobile phones. It's like, no, now they're just phones. And that's the goal. That's the goal for me, right? That at some point it's just me. Like Tesla, when it first came out, and, you know, forget about all the other baggage that now is attached to the guy who founded Tesla. But when it first came out, the idea was like, they started with this sports car and it was $150,000. But the idea was like, this is an awesome car. They weren't saying like, get this car because it's great for the earth. Get this car because like, we need to get off fossil fuels. They just sold Tesla as like a better mousetrap. And enough people liked them that, you know, it really achieved a fair amount of market share to move the needle. Now, look, remember, there was a big problem about 10 years ago that electric cars were seen as like Obama mobiles, right?
Yeah.
They were like woke cars. And that became a problem in making it go mainstream. And now today we're seeing some of that same stuff where it's like kind of Biden burgers, right? Like that's like woke meat. And that's what Ron DeSantis said when he banned cultivated meat in the state of Florida. I mean, part of what he was saying is like, we stand with cattlemen, right? Because of course, like, you know, they don't want a competitor. But he also said, like, you know, we're not going to let these people make us eat bugs and this fake meat. And again, of course, what he's saying is like, we're going to tell you what kind of meat to eat. But it's just getting swept up in the culture war. And I do think that's dangerous. You know, these days, everything gets swept up in the culture war. But, you know, ideally, just like GMOs became like Frankenfood before it even came to market. You don't want this stuff to be seen as Franken meat or like, you know, lab meat or junk meat. You want it to just be meat.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Rick, go ahead.
So can we talk a little bit about the cattle industry in Florida? Because, yeah. You know, we had this person on a couple weeks ago and talked about the benefits to the land, you know, by some of the cattle ranchers here in Florida. So how does that work in the equation?
You know, there's this saying in the ranching, particularly among regenerative ranchers, right? That it's not the cow, it's the how. You know, pardon the pun, but that is mostly bullshit. It's mostly the cow. You know, cows use a lot of land. They burp a lot of methane. They're extremely inefficient converters of their feed into our food. So, you know, there's not really a, like, you know, it's like kind of climate friendly beef is sort of like, you know, it's like, I don't know, healthy cigarettes or something. I mean, you can do it more or less badly, but it's not going to be great. And I will say, you know, as the old Everglades guy, you know, the reason that Lake Okeechobee is a sewer, you know, one of the reasons that we have these algal blooms in the east and west, you know, east and the west coast estuaries, is because of all that crap from the Kissimmee Valley and from Central Florida, sort of washing down into the lake.
Did you ever see the? I forget if it was a booklet that it was put out with the line art of the cow crying because it was drowning in the Kissimmee Valley floodplain. I mean, they.
Sure, yeah, that was the whole reason for the Central and South Florida flood.
Yep. I always joke that, yeah, they sold the land to the cattle ranchers during the dry season. And when the wet season came, everybody went, what the hell just happened? Because they had no clue. But, you know, the cattle ranching industry, is there a path you see if, let's say, hypothetically, people decided to reduce beef consumption to one day a week? Perfect world. Is there a path to any type of sustainable beef ranching, or is that just off the table, hard stop?
Well, again, it's more and less. And so one of the sort of takeaways of my book, like when I point out that beef is 10 times worse than chicken and pork, you know, so one of the takeaways is like, obviously, like, yeah, we should try to eat less beef. But another takeaway is like, it would be way better for the planet if it was only 3 or 4 times worse than chicken or pork. And the best way to do that is to make more beef with less land. I went down to Brazil and I visited a bunch of degraded ranches, where you'll see like one cow for every 10 acres. And they basically they call it like the Columbus method, where you send the cows out to graze in the fall, and then you go discover them in the spring, right? And these cows, let me tell you, they look like they're on hunger strikes. Like they are not happy cows. But then I went to other ranches that had been improved, and they do some stuff there that Michael Pollan would hate, right? They fertilize their pastures, right? So there's, that's very unnatural. They also have feedlots, right? So they're feeding their cattle grain. And it's like, oh no, we want them to just eat grass. But the fact is they have one cow per acre. So they are 10 times as efficient, and they are using 1/10 as much of the Amazon. And here's another thing. They are also using a bunch of the regenerative practices that Michael Pollan would love. they're using rotational grazing, sort of mob grazing, kind of mimicking the patterns of natural ruminants out on the plains. They're letting their cattle graze their cover crops. So they're integrating their livestock with their crops, which is a big regenerative practice. So I'm not saying like, this is how you should farm. This is how you should graze. This is how you should ranch. What I'm saying is we need to make more food with less agricultural land. Because this is what Michael Pollan really gets wrong. And it's true. We've talked about some of the problems with when you turn those nice rustic farms and ranches into these kind of modern, intense, industrial farms and ranches, and you drench them with chemicals and you have these feedlots, and it's not always pretty. But the real environmental catastrophe is the transformation of nature into agriculture. That's when you lose all the carbon. That's when you lose all the biodiversity. And we've forgotten that. And the way to prevent that is to, you know, make more food on the agricultural land that we already have so that we don't need more of it. And I do think that a lot of people who talk about, like Michael Pollan in particular, when he talks about like this kind of like idealized cattle grazing, it's not more efficient grazing. It's just a grazing that, in his opinion, kind of looks more like nature. But there's a reason that we transform nature into agriculture. It's because nature isn't as good as feeding people. So we should use agriculture to feed people, and then we should have more nature for nature.
More nature for nature. I like that. That's the t-shirt this week, Rick.
Yeah, more nature for nature. We're
going to put a link to the show notes, a link to your new book and your old book, in the show notes. And we're also going to put some information about you. What would be the one takeaway before we go? What would be the one takeaway you want people to get from your book? What's the biggest thing?
Well, it is kind of what it says on the cover, right? That we are eating the earth, that the 2 of every 5 acres of the planet are now agricultural, that we are losing a soccer field worth of tropical forest every 6 seconds. Oh. And it's because of our diets. But also that it's like a solvable problem. And so, yeah, like individuals, the way to solve it is basically eat less beef and waste less food. Because, you know, when we waste food, we waste the farmland and the fertilizer and the water that's used to grow that food. And we shouldn't be using a landmass the size of China to grow garbage. That's stupid. But also it's about policy, and it's about technology. Like we do need, you know, we need policies that will incentivize us to eat less of the earth. We need technologies that will help us to eat less of the earth. And I do think it's possible. I think that idea that I talked about how better is better than worse, is really important for all kinds of climate issues. We're not going to solve them tomorrow, but it's dumb to just sort of throw our hands up in the air and be like, this is too big a problem. Like the scientists say, we're already going to blow past 1.5 degrees of global warming. It's like, that's probably true, but 1.6 would be better than 1.7. And so, you know, I wrote about this as like, it's a book about a problem and about how to solve it. And you know, I think like, I like problem solvers. I don't like them. I like them a lot more than ideologues who just sort of throw their hands up in the air and say, we're all doomed, or like, you know, it's this guy's fault or it's that corporation's fault. I'm into this idea like, hey, you know, humans have kind of made a mess of some things. Let's try to make less of a mess.
All right. Well, Michael Pollan might disagree, but thank you for being on the show, Michael Grunwald. We will only put links to your books in the show notes. If you want to see what we said about Michael Pollan, you can go back to the past episode where we talked about cattle ranching and why it might be sustainable. But I hope
he's a really good writer. I wish he wasn't, you know, quite so talented at portraying such bad ideas.
Everybody has a different take on things, and it can feel like a little bit of a struggle sometimes to, what do I even do? You know, because your first thought is, oh, well, I'll just eat fish, you know, because my Italian grandmother, if you were a vegetarian, you ate chicken and fish. But then you get into, you want to eat local. So, but if you eat local in the Gulf of Mexico, things are overfished. It can feel like a lot. And I can appreciate that people might want to throw their hands up. So I appreciate that you're like, okay, incremental is the way to go. Like, we are an all or nothing society. So I appreciate the attitude, and I hope people embrace this, that you can do a little bit better. You don't have to do everything all the time.
And the facts matter, right? Like, eating local doesn't really help that much. I mean, it matters much more what you eat and how it's grown. And so, like, I do think, like, people hate the data, people hate the science, but it's like the place to start.
He was an interesting guest.
Yes, I think he's brilliant. I think he's a great writer. The point, I think, that I'd like to say is that cattle ranchers in Florida, you know, that's been used for cattle, my understanding is, for generations. You know, it's the same places you read about in Land Remembered are the same place they're raising cattle now. That's what I'm talking about anyways. That's better than strip malls and condos and asphalt parking lots and retention ponds, which is, you know, what you see throughout so much of the state. And I think that's an alternative. It's not an efficient way to make food, but, you know, from a water perspective, you know, all that, the rain that falls on pasture lands is recharging the aquifer. And, well, and that's what's important.
I think some of where my disagreements or my issues with some of what Grunwald Michael writes, you know, I don't just approach it from what's better for the planet. I do think about those cows being raised. I do think about feedlots and that. And that's maybe more of a Buddhist perspective, which one day will probably lead me to give up meat 7 days a week, is that I do think that, you know, animals have a presence, if you want to call it a soul or whatever. And I think yeah. that when we willingly decide to put them in feedlots and cram them in like that, I think there's a cost to that. And you know, that's, I appreciate that he is absolutely accurate from the perspective he has for what he is writing about. But I think that we don't exist in a vacuum, and that you have to consider, I guess, the zeitgeist, if you will, the whole of the problem. And I, you know, we don't buy a lot of meat in this house. We don't buy a lot of beef in this house. Let's put it that way. So, you know, I do buy something that's been farmed locally, because it might be better for the planet if my berries are grown in a big mass production farm like that. But we also know that the certain fruits and vegetables, the longer they spend in transit, the more they degrade and there's less value for you.
Well, you're also helping your local community. You're helping the farmer out down the road, as opposed to, you know, somebody who is working for a corporation. And, you know, that brings up the whole thing about, you know, corporations and the 1% and all that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah. And then environmental stewardship matters too, I think.
Yeah, it's a complicated thing, you know, and I think he is coming at it from one perspective, and that's part of it. You know, so I posted our talk about the Akawaha and some on my Facebook page, and somebody said, "What can we do?"
And it's like a million dollar question, right?
I haven't responded yet because it's so big, but like, I think, you know, one of the things I always go to is native plants. It's like, take one part of your yard, make it a native plant area. You don't have to devote your whole yard at first. So I think on this topic, it's like, eat meat one less meal a week, you know, or one less day a month, and start there. You know, start somewhere. I think. I don't know.
I think that's there's a great cookbook called Weekday Vegetarians, and it's a great cookbook because the recipes are actually good. I would say there's a lot of cheese in there in those recipes. So I think Michael's right that a lot of vegetarians are very cheese heavy. But you can work around those. But Weekday Vegetarians, I think they approached it from, they were going to be vegetarians Monday morning through Friday afternoon. And then Friday night through Sunday night, they can eat meat. And it's hard. You know, we are very much, especially America, we are an all or nothing society. I'm going to be a vegan and I'm only going to eat organic, whole food, plant-based, no oil. It's exhausting and it's not sustainable for a lot of people. Now, there are some people who do great with that and I applaud them. But what happens, and this is not my opinion, this has been studied, people try and do it, and when they fail, they throw up their hands, and it's called something like the oh well phenomenon. Oh well, if I can't do it right, why do it at all? Let me just go get a Big Mac. And so I like his approach of, you know, incremental. I think that's important.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and I think if you could, you know, like with native plants, start with a native plant. You know, I think about some of my best friends and I battle them on native plants and made no headway. And it's like, I think I'm just going to buy them a plant, you know, maybe this Christmas. I'll just buy people native plants who have yards and take it over to them and offer to plant it for them. You know, the tough thing with native plants is, you know, you could buy them a plant and it might not work for the location they have available.
Well, yeah, there's a lot that goes into it, but
yeah. And it, you know, I will agree with him, you know, as a vegetarian, I'm not full vegan. The vegan cheeses aren't there yet.
Are an abomination. I've tried. I really have tried because cheese is my, first of all, cheese doesn't make me feel good. I will crave it, and cheese, I may have a problem with quantity. you know, but so I've tried. I've tried the Kite Hill. I've tried any number of plant-based cheeses, and they should be illegal.
Well, I have been to some restaurants where they'll like, you know, make a fettuccine Alfredo with a cashew sauce, and it's really good. But, you know, if I were doing a blind taste test and comparing it to fettuccine Alfredo made at Olive Garden or someplace, there's no comparison. But if you're not comparing, they're delightful meals. The stuff, though, the slice stuff, it's just not the same. And so that's one reason I'm not full on vegan yet. And I do, you know, I enjoy seafood. You know, to me, part of the Florida culture is going to seafood restaurants. You know, I love that. You know, I love going and get fried shrimp and hush puppies, you know, and it at a place that has taxidermy on the wall and sitting by the water. It's just part of living in Florida, and I'm not ready to give that up yet.
Every vegan listener we have is clutching their simulated pearls.
Well,
right now.
I'd love to hear from them. You know, I do think I'm always open to hearing new ideas, and you know, maybe that'll allow some shift to occur. You know, they haven't made a vegan alternative to fried shrimp yet that I'm aware of.
My Achilles heel, oysters and shrimp. We were in Port St. Joe last week, and we were camping at, oh God, such a long name, T.H. Stone St. Joseph Peninsula Memorial State Park, which is Cape San Blas. And right on the way in, there's a little seafood market, and it's, I think it's called Port St. Joe Shrimp Company or something. It doesn't matter. We were coming in, knew we needed food that night. So I went in, got a pound of shrimp, and they had shrimp dip, which I had never seen shrimp dip because it was like fish dip, but with shrimp.
Yum.
And oh my God, I was like, well, I'm going to save this and bring it home and try and recreate it. And no, it did not last. It was, I mean, I should have just poured it into a shot glass and thrown them back, you know? So I have some weaknesses. I'm going down today. We have a journalism conference down in Naples, and I've already been looking. They have a raw bar at the restaurant, and I am very excited about that. So, I am looking forward to hearing from our readers and would really like to know what they think about everything that we talked about today. You can always reach out to us, Kathy with a C, C-A-T-H-Y, at Florida Spectacular. And before we get into our regular listeners, we got a really nice note alongside a donation. I guess somebody didn't want to go through Buzzsprout, so they just sent us a donation for PayPal to give them. And it's... Solcata Grove is their name, and they said, just a little gift as a thank you for the great podcasts that entertained and educated my husband and I as we drove to the Keys for our 30th anniversary. We enjoyed the lionfish sushi at Castaways. And that is, because I guess I'm sure I talked about lionfish sushi. You know, lionfish, of course, is an invasive, exotic invasive that is eating the Florida fish. And so you can buy it at certain restaurants in the Keys. And I am just so pleased that someone made the point of stopping at Castaways, which is not a long US-1. They had to go out of their way to find it. It is not a fancy restaurant, and had the lionfish sushi. So thank you for doing your part to get rid of lionfish in the Florida Keys, and also for the donation. We appreciate it.
I have to say, I've been thinking a lot about lionfish. That's my latest project. I'm at ceramics, you know, and I'm doing a lionfish right now. Fascinating creatures. I, at one point I was going to do like a whole thing of all natives and invasives, you know, that is definitely an invasive. And I love that they, if you follow like FWC social media, they'll have these things where they have people go and catch as many lionfish as they can and just get them out of there because they're so bad. But they are really beautiful. They belong in aquariums, but not in our waters.
I just wrote an article for, you talk about invasives. I just wrote an article for one of my clients, a Disney fan magazine, and I did a short piece on the Key Largo wood rat. Because for a time there, the Walt Disney Company's animal sciences and conservation arm was trying to repopulate the wood rats. So they took in wood rats. They had a very successful breeding program. And if you go back into the archives, as early as I think 2009, the Walt Disney Company was talking about Burmese pythons and on their website cautioning people, please do not release pets. You know, that's how we got the python problem. It's how we got the lionfish problem. They were in fish tanks and people released the fish into their local waterways.
Yeah.
Into their local.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember I didn't have lionfish, but I remember I had a 10-gallon tropical fish tank. And when I didn't want it anymore, my dad and I went down to the Courtney Campbell Causeway and just dumped it in the water because we didn't know, right? We didn't know. We were like, well, this is a better life. I mean, I think we should have known that dumping tropical freshwater fish into salt water was a great idea.
Yeah, you might as well just flush them down the toilet.
I feel bad now. I just realized that was just something I realized this second that it was a freshwater tank. And oh boy. I'm sorry, fish. I'm just so sorry.
I did it the old fashioned way. I let them die in my aquarium because I ultimately got a big channel catfish that ate anything else I put in there. And then the channel catfish got too big for the aquarium. So I sold it to a pet store.
Okay. Well, I mean, I know the local retention pond in our neighborhood has some big Placostomus in it that I am pretty sure started life as a $2.59 purchase from Pet Food Warehouse.
They're everywhere. I hate those damn things. Plecos!
It's not their fault. It's not their fault.
We should say thanks some people and get out of here because we're running long.
I know we are. If you're still with us, let us thank Michael Gargulak, who is our longest time listener. Michael, please email me and tell me what inspired you to join right away because we so appreciate that. Ryan Worthington, who we do the Submerged Stories Facebook group, soon to come podcast about hidden history in Florida. Sunshine State Seekers is his other group, Florida Excursionist. Ryan's into everything Florida. John Bowne, Angela Connolly, Natalie Zachrick, Davita Breyer. Davita sent me, she sends me swag. She sent me all these wonderful stickers that I came home to after my road trip. Thank you, Davita. Leslie Hallweg, who is actually local to where I live. Carol Miller, Elise Smith, who was very sweet on our Instagram, Rick. And when she saw the dog, she's like, let's go get him. I'm like, I'm serious. I'll go get that dog, Elise, if you want a road trip. But he's found a rescue. I want a quick update. So long. Memphis Animal Services, the dog we were talking about last episode, they found a rescue to put him into.
That must feel so good.
I was in tears yesterday and I was ready to pay a friend who lived in South Carolina to go get him and bring him here and worry about it afterwards. And I texted the woman at the animal services. She's like, wait, I think we have a rescue. And so I woke up this morning to that news. So I'm very happy. Bet's Boys Adventure. The two boys, the young men in the Bet's Boys adventure, not the father, sent us a thank you note for the books we sent them last month, Rick.
Aww.
Yeah, it was funny because we mail stuff out of the newspaper office. So I got this note, this postcard, really cool postcard. Thank you for the kind words and the book. And I don't know if it was the father who wrote it, maybe he's a doctor, the handwriting, or if one of the young men wrote it. But at first I'm like, who was sending me a postcard to thank me for a book review? We didn't review an Alex. And then it finally dawned on me that it was because they sent it to the newspaper. I'm like, oh, this is the two
Bet's Boys.
Bet's Boys. Yeah. So thank you for the thank you note and the very cool postcard. Brian Woodall, Brad Sager, and Stephanie Hewley. I'm sorry we always leave you to last. Next week, I promise we'll start with you. Thank you all for supporting our podcast and sticking with it through this very long episode. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time on the Florida Spectacular.
Bye.